And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Howdy, Haunted House Hunters! Today, we see a movie about some asshole who doesn't appreciate a good thing when he sees it. I mean, who gets to inherit a pre-haunted house from their crusty old aunt for free? I mean, all my crazy aunts are renters. So this house basically was a babysitter for free for 3 freaking years, and even lets this guy hang out with his dead war buddy all he wants. And all this thankless prick does is cry about it for the whole movie and then burn it down. It makes me sick. Anyway, here's a movie where the greatest American hero takes a rare role as the villain. 1985's House.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am your host this evening, Mr. Luke Giaconetti, and I'm not in this abode. I'm not in this residential district by myself. No, I've got the usual gang of freaks. This ain't a neighborhood. This is a residential district. And so the usual gang of freaks here with me. So left to right across the living room, up first, my brother, Mr. Jason Giaconetti.
My sister was an only child, and you abused her.
I can never forget that. And you heard him there. Next up, the hair metal hero, Chris Tyler.
Jimmy!
Let's keep repeating it and just keep repeating it. And finally, rounding out our little dwelling party. I don't know. Is that the right thing? Is Two True Freaks OG Chris Honeywell.
What about me? Do you think I'm Looney Tunes?
Yes. 100%.
So if you can't figure it out from that, we are taking a look at The film alternately credited to either 1985 or 1986, depending on which source you looked at. But it's from 1985, and it is the film House. Not to be confused with the crazy Japanese film from 1977. And also called House, but also not to be confused with the series of films with Kid and Play, which was House Party.
Or the Fox television show.
Yeah, that prick doctor.
Yeah, that it where it's not it's never lupus, except that one time that it was lupus. Right, but you know what? Fuck all that shit, because we're taking a look at Steve Miner's House, produced by Sean Cunningham, a very well-known horror rack hanger-on. I can very clearly see the cover to this with disembodied zombie hand ringing the doorbell, and it says in very large, friendly letters, "Ding dong, you're dead," on the cover of this VHS, which was released in 86. And that comes, that was on the shelf, I think, of every single pop video store everywhere. Just this was a movie that hung on VHS for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah. And it was a cable mainstay and a UHF mainstay.
You know, yep. I just thought of this. Did the house even kill one single person in this whole movie?
The aunt.
Oh, yes.
The aunt, yeah.
Yes, okay, yes. Okay, so then yes, one.
I was about to mention very low body count in this film.
Yeah,
so significantly low.
So the thing about House, okay, and I'm just gonna throw this out there, is that this film doesn't know if it wants to be scary or funny, and not gonna bury the lead here. I don't know that it succeeds particularly well at either one. The fact that this, I said this in the group chat earlier today before we recorded it, the fact that this spawned any sequels, let alone a series of sequels, admittedly, that were in name only, you would have to have been psychic in order to predict
painted a picture of it.
Did it make a lot of money? That's all that really is the measure of that. If it made,
I mean, it made
good return on its budget. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it made $22 million off of $3 million, but there's not a lot here other than the title that would suggest that, hey, we can make movies out of this, right? I mean, it's just that's just me. Now, just to close the loop here, the sequels were sequels essentially in name only. The second one, which is the best known of the sequel, which is called House 2, the second story. Ba-dum-bum, leans very hard in the comedy direction.
Yes.
And was also from an original story by Fred Decker. Jay, your boy, Fred Decker.
Yeah.
And but then the two other sequels, House 3, The Horror Show, there's a whole podcast right there just on the making of that film. And then House 4, I've never seen House 4, but House 3 I know leans more in a horror direction. So it's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of an oddball. It's like, oh, it's a series. It's like, is it though? Is it? You know, it's one of those things.
We
it's like,
call it an anthology.
You could call it an anthology. And what's funny is that, believe it or not, the House films also became entries in another loose-knit horror series in, wait for it, Italy, where it was part of the Ghost House series. They just called it like, it is called, they just named them whatever number and just rolled with it, you know?
Yep. So the thing is, this story, which is, again, a Fred Decker story, it started out as part of an anthology, a horror anthology, and it was just a short little story, and they fleshed it out to make it into a more full-length horror movie. But when they did that, they realized that they're doing this. The studio kind of wanted more of a comedy. So a lot of comedy was kind of shoehorned in after the fact, which is why the comedy parts don't work as well as other horror comedies designed to be comedies. You know what I'm saying? Especially from the 80s. So if you look back at Return of the Living Dead, like that's supposed to be a horror comedy. And the horror in that movie is, you know, the zombies are zombies, but the comedy parts of it, are there. But then in Return of the Living Dead Part 2, where they really turn the comedy part up, especially some of the one-liners and stuff like that, they kind of knew what they worked well in the first one. And they kind of just hey, let's push it more in the second one. So that's what but the problem with House was this was made to be Steve Miner making a serious horror movie, but it was supposed to be an anthology of little short stories. And they all were supposed to either take place in the house or have something to do with the house or whatever. Like, that's the whole idea. Like, it was never supposed to be, it was supposed to be a whole slew of some underlying tied together, Creepshow. But it didn't work out. And Fred Decker, who, for those of you who are not familiar with what I'm saying here, Fred Decker wrote Fred Decker drew Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps. And also one of the RoboCop 3. So, but the thing is, what you wind up doing is when you have, the short story getting fleshed out, what winds up happening all the time is if it was good enough originally to be a full length, screenplay or whatever, it would have been that. And then you start having, this feels like a Twilight Zone episode. It literally feels like an episode of Twilight Zone that they kind of fleshed out to 90 minutes. This could have been a 30 minute banger.
Yeah, well, they took a Twilight Zone premise and they worked a few more premises in there to get it up to 90 minutes.
Yeah, they shoehorned other things in with it. And if this was a 30 minute segment as part of an anthology, because Twilight Zone the movie and stuff like that, it might have worked as a straight horror thing, you not needing the comedy, but be as it may. And I just want to say this though, because I've seen this movie several times. Luke and I have seen this when we were younger and stuff. I never realized how utterly depressing this movie is until I watched it again this time.
It's pretty fucking depressing until the end.
It's until the very end. This movie is insanely depressing. I always kind of got the PTSD stuff. But I think also now too, and this is a big thing too. We're now at a point where we don't talk about Vietnam anymore, especially not on film, unless we're making a very serious movie. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
yeah, but in the 80s, Vietnam was still fresh enough. Where
it was
people
was like a whole genre in the 80s. In the 90s, heroin addicts were a genre. And in the 80s, it was Vietnam. And And this is sort of like this pastiche. This has like all the 80s stuff thrown in it. It's R-rated, but it basically just seems like a PG. It's got PG-13 written all over it. It just feels PG-13 to the core. But it's got like this solid group of, like, when you see the credits at the beginning and you see that long
Decker,
shot
Minor,
all the way
Anthony,
around the house.
Cunningham.
Yeah, you're like going, okay, and then you see the cast and you're like, wow, they got a solid bunch of actors. But then when the story's good, like the whole movie probably shouldn't have worked because it's got like, we got a little Poltergeist in there. A smidge of Evil Dead in there.
I'll probably be the outlier on this one because this is one of those.
Little Hamburger Hill.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this hit when I was 6 years old, so I probably saw it when I was 7. So at that age, I'm roughly the same age as his son or the other little boy that's in the movie. So when I watched this as a kid, this thing was fucking gangbusters for me. Like, I was terrified.
I saw this in the theater with my buddies.
Say that. Yeah. Oh, I'm not saying that I do still actually like this movie. It's just I never realized the stuff I now get as watching it as someone who is now older, who is now a dad, someone who's lost a child, someone who's whatever. Like, those things now shade how I see it. But I mean, I remember this movie. When I put it on, I'm like, oh, yep, here it comes. Like, I remembered all the little gags and stuff. I forgot that Buzz Off was mentioned by name in the movie.
Yeah!
Superman was in there. The cool effects and the stuff I remember. Like, I remember the trailer, George Wentz going, whatever I do, Roger, the last thing I do, I won't let you go. And he lets him go. Like, that was in the trailer. Like, I remember seeing that trailer hundreds of times. It's a movie from the 80s that's just part of my youth and whatever, but I just never realized how depressing things were there, because I think in 85, 86 and stuff, you just didn't realize that stuff.
Author, he's divorced, his kid's gone, his aunt that raised him is dead.
Yeah.
I mean, the neighbor next door is a dink. He's got, nobody wants his new book that he's trying to write. Like, it's almost a fucking Stephen King story.
Right.
Yeah, it is. And it's like that. And like, it's almost like they had two stories, because there's the lead character as a writer and as a Vietnam veteran. And I think they sort of flubbed on the, everybody was used to like big budget, crazy shot on location Vietnam movies. And this was basically shot in a soundstage. It's the world's smallest, it's like two little clumps of foliage that they crawl around for all the Vietnam shots.
Yeah.
But he's a Vietnam veteran, but like when he's handling like weapons and stuff, he's just totally, he's acting like, you know, your standard like horror writer who's never really messed with guns or anything, you know. He's doing things that are like kind of like not gun, you know, he doesn't comport himself like a Vietnam veteran.
Well, he comports himself like a nerdy writer.
Yes, but like he's been in war and like killed people and gone through basic training and stuff. And so he's, when it comes to the battle part, like fighting the stuff, and granted, he's also got PTSD, and he's also got PTSD from like his kid disappearing. But I think the kid disappearing probably didn't seem as dark then, because they were just like, because it was just sort of everybody, I think, watching it was like, oh, it's a Carol Ann situation, you know?
Yeah.
The kid just got Carol Ann. So I don't know if anybody was like really like, you know, thinking that the kid wasn't going to come back by the end of the movie, you know?
Well, it's like Jesus Christ, he does, because I mean, like Jay was saying, it's a pretty fucking bleak movie for a pretty bloodless it's definitely treading mostly on its atmosphere and its performances, and you really can't fault any of them in this. I mean, you're pulling in Richard Mall, right? And it's like, you know, you're gonna get a good performance out of him no matter what he's doing. And then when he's in the fucking makeup at the end, like that big. Big Ben is one of those things that, like, that fucking design haunted me as a child. More than the monster in the closet.
Really dialed himself back for it, though. It made himself more like a serious character who was just a little wacky, but he wasn't his usual Richard Mall, you know. He was Ox. He wasn't Bull. So.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, too, is with...
bovines.
Both Cunningham and Minor really felt that when they kind of fleshed the story out. They had idea that Big Ben could become kind of like another horror icon character, but then they didn't know how they were going to use it in sequels and stuff like that. But they thought, like, if this really hits, if he really catches on, we could have the next Freddy Krueger. We could have the next Jason Voorhees. Remember, Sean Cunningham. Again, his movie doesn't have Jason Voorhees in it, but, like, he literally, the Friday the 13th Part 1.
Yeah. How much money that can make, for sure.
Steve Miner. Miner was on. Miner and Cunningham are on all the early Fridays. That's them. And the thing
I got to jump in here and I got to ask Luke a question. So Big Ben's design, right? Yeah. Do you think that was influential in Stormtroopers of Death getting their cover art, their mascot, their logo?
I think Big Ben is. The thing is that. So what Big Ben reminded me of more so was any modern story from, like, modern air quotes up to the mic, modern for when it was published story in Weird War Tales over at DC. Right.
Okay.
And then the Vertigo Weird War Tales. So I think the idea of the zombified soldier.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that came out of, so, you know, Jay, you were talking about, you know, and Chris, you were saying about talking about Vietnam in the 80s and all that. I think once we started digging into telling Vietnam stories that were outside of, you know, more of the cinema verite hard look at Vietnam, when we started getting into the horror stories and stuff like that, I think Big Ben is a perfect encapsulation of that style, right? So I think that the later things using that was building on a lot of the pop culture imagery of the idea of taking, at that point, we had moved past whether, you know, we had moved past both, like, the Deer Hunter and First Blood, right? The idea that soldiers were all damaged and should be, you know, are dangerous, or move past that soldiers are damaged and need respect and concern. Yeah. Right. And we were starting to tell different stories. So the idea of taking that and putting it in a horror context works really well with Big Ben. And I will say that I didn't particularly enjoy watching this film. I hadn't seen House in probably three decades. I remember the second one a lot more than the first one.
Me too.
And I was like, wow, this is a long 92 minutes. This is a long 92 minutes right now. But I will say, across the board, the creature effects are fantastic.
Yeah.
When Big Ben shows up in that last reel, it's like, okay, we are in gear and going, and it's nonstop as soon as he shows up.
Once it delves into the Lovecraftian and the surreal, it definitely goes to another level.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's one of those things where, even though it's getting as crazy as it is, what does Walter do? I'm going to go and get all this AV equipment to prove that I'm not fucking crazy and that there's something in the house, you know?
And you know what I liked, I will say, in all of the, that it was all the 80s, there was so many boxes of Quasar monitors. You know, at the time, Quasar was owned by, eventually Quasar would be bought by Panasonic, but at that point, Quasar was Motorola's brand for all their televisions. Right, so all the monitors are Quasar and all that. I love that whole delivery truck of 80s tech, right? There's some nerd at a Radio Shack going, oh, yeah, there it is. Good stuff right here. Look at that, yeah.
What's that YouTube channel? There's a British guy who does all, like,
vintage. Yeah, I watch him, too. I can't remember what the name of it is.
Tech Mode.
Yeah, his stuff is great.
Yeah, he would kill for that truck to drive up to his house, I'm sure.
So, before we get off this, I don't know if anyone else kind of, remember when, Jesus, got to remember, it's got to be the late.
Some folk weren't allowed to vote?
No, Remember when his father remembers? Like in Spawn, when they show Al Simmons, you know, when he's zombified kind of thing. Like, isn't there? I'm trying to remember. There's definitely a toy of it. I'm trying to remember when that was in Spawn. Like when they talk about him when he's, you know, isn't there one where they made it kind of look like Big Ben in the like one of the comics I'm thinking had that in it.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I read that first 50 issues of Spawn.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, I mean, I was never a big Spawn guy, but, like, I remember that image of a zombified Al Simmons looking, right? I'm saying this right. It's Al Simmons, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Al Simmons.
And I'm trying to remember when, you know, as Spawn, but he looked like a zombie, right? At some point, I mean, I remember him being in the comic and they flash him back to that, but I thought at some point they had him as a zombie. But
anytime he would take the hood off, he was all desiccated and
no, but I'm saying, so it's in Spawn 23 Mutations. It literally looks like it's him all chewed up. It's in the toy line. Definitely in the toy line. They have a version of it. I remember that more explicitly than any comic book. But he's like literally ripped to shreds. He's all gunned up, whatever kind of thing. And that had to come out of the comics because at some point they had to have that. But I just don't remember when.
But that's that image, right? I mean, I don't want to get too far into the psyche of that, right? Of why do we take our soldiers and turn them into monsters? That's a whole other topic that's kind of outside of what I think we're shooting for here. But I think the imagery there is strong, right? I mean, to the point that not too long ago, DC did a series called G.I. Zombie, where the whole shtick was that he was an intelligent zombie who had, you know, the joke was he had more than one life to give for his country, right? He
could What was that one we watched on 4th of July, the one year was it Uncle Sam.
Yeah. I love Uncle Sam.
That would be a good,
he's wearing his dress uniform even.
But like the thought of Big Ben being a recurring character does, I guess, you know, I mean, Jason wasn't even in the first Friday the 13th as the killer, so you could do whatever you want. But like Big Ben struck me as not like Big Ben like being the heel of it. Is he was just sort of what the house was using.
Right.
To get at William Catt. It was like his own personal demon that the house used to manipulate him, sort of like The Shining or something like that.
That's part of the problem I had, is that to me it's not clear what the hell is going on. I defy anyone to explain with any certainty. Is the house screwing with him, or is this the long game that Ben used to screw with him? Because there's no answer given. And most of the time I'm cool with that. But I'm watching this, I'm like, I don't know. I can't wrap my head around what is the direction here. Is this like his aunt said, and the house is playing tricks on you? And this is all the house fucking with him? It's like, dude, leave.
The house just must be trying to get people to commit suicide, and has his son as hope, and then like everything else as, you know. And I mean, like the shot where the house tricked him into thinking he'd shot his wife on the doorstep.
Yeah.
But that would have been usually the point where he went inside and, like, you know, swallowed a shotgun or something. Speaking of swallowing a shotgun, here's an 80s thing. You go out in the old garden shed, and there's just guns hanging up on the wall in the garden shed. Like the rifle, okay, you know. I can sort of see like somebody having a 22, but a pistol just sort of hanging out on the pegboard.
In California, no less. Because doesn't George Wendt say, oh, you're an athletics fan? Right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in Oakland, maybe. Yeah. They probably do have guns hanging up in the garage, and that part of California, right?
But the thing is also too, when you watch this now, like, I mean, again, we're like, you look back at this, you know, all these years later, the thing is this whole movie, again, knowing what we know about how the story was, whatever, and you can see where pieces were kind of sewn together. But the entire movie kind of reminds me. Remember in Evil Dead 2 when Ash dies, are we supposed to? And then like all the shit goes crazy. You're like, he's got to be dead, right? Like this is the nightmare world.
What's the old thought that when the camera zooms at him and he wakes up, He yeah. dies when the camera zooms, and the rest of it he's in hell.
Yes, but that's what this movie feels like, right? Like you're watching this going, yeah. things just don't make sense. The, like he invites him over for a baseball game at midnight, but they're in California. The game, like what games at midnight? Like the things just don't make sense. And then because, but I think part of it is that it's, and again, and I'm not trying to knock like you know whatever, but like they're kind of put those things together. So if you read it as if he's stuck in this nightmarish hell that he's living, that the house is causing all these things that just don't seem real, because we know it's already doing that. But like the other stuff that doesn't kind of jive up time-wise or fit perfectly or whatever, is it the house just altering it enough to make it seem off, but he's not realizing it's off? You know, like, I don't know.
I mean, you could have chalked up him being an unreliable narrator from either the house trying to make him crazy, or maybe he just has PTSD and it's all, you know, a projection of his psyche and stuff. They could have gone that. I'm kind of relieved that they didn't, because it's sort of a process that sort of happens in films a lot that I don't really like want to. I'm a little tired. I like that it just sort of, this movie just sort of went like, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's okay. And, yeah. and I remember seeing it in the theater, and it was one of those movies where all my friends and I went to the movies and we said, this is the only genre, this is a horror movie. We weren't particularly jazzed to see it, or I'm sure we'd seen, you know, previews or whatever, or ads for it, but we were like, yeah, let's just go in. And we had real low expectations. And by the end of it, we were like, you know, I enjoyed that, even though I probably shouldn't have. And we enjoyed it enough that we went and saw House 2 in the theater. And we're like, yeah. that was, and I remember, I don't remember much about it, except it was more over the top and thinking, well, that was better than it really should have been. It's not great. It wasn't great, but it was better than I would have expected. And I sort of felt the same way this time, but I just was able to put my finger on what didn't work in it more than I did the first time.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, House 2 is a very different beast all to itself, but at least House 2 is much more related to House, this movie, because they're actually designed to be a sequel, unlike House 3, which wasn't even a House movie, they just called it that. But, even funnier, and this, I just got to throw this out there. When, so what's his name? So, Sean Cunningham, he was in Hong Kong doing promotion for the movie, and the movie came out, and they called the movie Don't Go Into the Haunted House After Midnight. There's nothing I love more than international titles that are 100% spot on, because just like when Dr. No came out, and in, I think it was Japan,
it was
or
in
China.
Japan, yes. So.
It says no doctors. It says no doctor is required. That was one of the translations.
Yeah, that's what they took it as.
Yeah, because it's the doctor. No, oh, no doctor is required, right? Oh. But it's just funny as heck.
I will say, believe it or not, there is, other than the Dr. No joke, there is in fact a James Bond connection to this movie. Okay.
Okay.
So, Mary Stavin, who plays Tanya, okay, plays the neighbor, right? Who voiced her kid off on Roger to watch, okay? So Mary Stavin, she appears in not one but two James Bond movies. So she is one of the girls at Octopussy's Circus girl. So she's a minor background character in Octopussy. Okay. And then she actually has a minor speaking role in the next film, A View to a Kill. So if you're a member of View to a Kill, as well you should, right? And if you don't, shame on you, okay? So at the beginning, Bond is in Siberia to go rescue the microchip from 003's, that 003 is carrying in his locket, right?
Yeah. Right.
And he gets back submarine, which is described as part of an iceberg.
Yeah.
Well, she plays Kimberly Jones, who is the MI6 agent who is driving the submarine. And, you know, Bond seduces her and says, well, it's 5 days to Alaska, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, however will we pass the time?
So, yes, I was like, and what's funny, if you want to get even, Now, if you believe in synchronicity, and which means that things either have, you know, they appear to have a causal connection, but they really don't. And I definitely believe in synchronicity, because fuck you, Dean Koontz, for writing that damn book. And now I see synchronicities everywhere. So I blame Dean Koontz.
You can blame Dean Koontz for everything. Koontz.
But, okay, so she plays the character Tanya. Her son's name is Robert, okay? She is in A View to a Kill. Who is the main
Tanya Roberts?
Tanya Roberts. Exactly. It's right there.
You're blowing my mind, man.
They all came out. They both came out in 1985.
Yeah.
It either means something or it doesn't. Okay. Yeah. You missed the call, but it's right there. Okay?
Do your own research, Grin. That's all I gotta say.
Read the book.
Do your research. Yeah.
So Steve Miner, we mentioned it already. Steve Miner went on to, he directed two of the Friday the 13th sequels. And then he obviously, after he finished those up, he did House. But what he wound up doing was, after House, he then went on to direct Soul Man, and then did the pilot episode of The Wonder Years, because that's what Steve Miner went on to do. It's just so funny. Nothing, I think, Steve Miner's, when you look at his career, He's like all over the 80s, you know, kind of thing, like in different aspects of like a producer, a writer, director.
Oh, man, a journeyman. Right?
But I'm just saying is, like, to go from doing Friday the 13th sequels, which make insane amounts of money, you then go on to make House, which, even if people don't remember the movie, they remember the poster. Soul Man, which is pretty forgettable. But then, like, Wonder Years.
I beg to differ. I beg to differ. Soul Man, if you've seen it, is a disaster that will live with you for the rest of your days.
Oh, okay. I've seen it. It's god awful, but that's what I'm saying. It's one of those movies you try to forget. I mean, it's kind of like if you ever saw Baby Ghost, and you're just like, God, please, no. Why do I have to remember this?
Isn't that a talking cat?
Okay. A talking cat is light years better than Baby Ghost, and they're all better than what's the one I showed Kelly there? Amazing
Filipino werewolf one?
The Amazing Bulk.
The
Amazing
Bulk.
My god. Because the thing is, is it Paradise Hotel? That was made like 2 years ago. That is so freaking bad. But then they showed that. Then I saw the trailer for Amazing Bulk, and I go, "Oh God, that movie looks competent compared to this." A talking cat is actually really well made compared to any of the schlock we just talked about there. My favorite part, though, is I try to figure: is there places in like real life conversation that I can work in the interrobang? You know, the exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point again. Haley and I have been trying to work it into conversation, but it just sounds like we're having a stroke, and it doesn't, you know, work very well. So, anyway,
the only thing I will say about a talking cat is that is by David DiCoteau, who is a name that is very familiar if you're a loser like me who loves Full Moon Entertainment, because he directed a bunch of movies for Full Moon. He also appears in a few of them too, but also, like, he did Puppet Master 3, but he also did Dr. Alien, so, you know, that's like the good and the bad, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, again, David DiCoteau did not direct House, and House is better than any of the movies we just said. I may not have cared for it too much this time, but I will say this. Now, what's interesting in, like, the contemporary reviews of House, one of the ones that stood out is that there's a lot of this. It actually had decent reviews. Like, I don't like Rotten Tomatoes, but it's useful for archival purposes. That actually, of the ones that they analyzed, it got 57% favorable reviews, which is pretty good for a horror movie in 1995, right? It's interesting now, like, the modern reevaluation of the film, it's being tagged as one of these, you know, we said it earlier, it's R, but it's really PG-13, of these PG-13, like, family-style horror movies, right? Because there are kids in peril, there are some scary scenes, but there's nothing gruesome about this, right? The creatures are extremely well done, but they're not gory. They're not ripping people to shreds, right? There's nothing about this that you couldn't show to. And I mean, my youngest is 10. I don't think there's anything in this that I couldn't have watched with all four of my kids here, you know?
Yeah, and just trim the, there's like one F-bomb in it, and there's no nudity. You could this, it's almost ready for cable, you know?
Twice it's really all the time.
It was definitely
take a cable
take a
little swearing out, and you probably you wouldn't have to really do much in it. There is a, even like the Vietnam stuff is like, couple squibs here and there, maybe even if that. I don't even know. I don't even know if I saw a squib.
It's not a bloody picture.
Yeah. So it was definitely had like cable in mind. Now, do you think with House 2, and this is a theory I have with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 also, is both those sequels I think might have been informed a little bit by they saw the evolution between Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, where Evil Dead 2 was just sort of almost the same thing, but the comedy and the over the top and the overtopness was just turned up to 11, and both of those movies like wanted to sort of like get in on that sort of aesthetic. That was sort of like the new, like a different direction at that time, where, because a lot of, like, 1985, and I think this is why it got good reviews, is the same reason we liked it. It was better done than the bad horror movies that were coming out at that time. So people went in with low expectations and were like, you know what, the performances in this are pretty solid, and you know, it's not bad, and it's different, you know. It's definitely like not super predictable. It's predictable in some ways, but it's, you know, it's just a weird mashup. And you know, if you're just expecting a slog through a haunted house movie or, you know, something, you didn't get that. And I think
it's not the traditional haunted house. The books aren't flying off the shelves. It's you know, it's not the, and there is still, it's still atmospheric, but it's not dabbling in most of the cliches of the haunted house genre. You know,
I'm thinking about it, Poltergeist was way gorier than this movie. Way more violent.
It's more violent. Yeah, there's no blood in Poltergeist, is there?
Well, the guy tears his face off. That fucking terrifies me.
Pulls his face off.
Yeah, but it wasn't like, yeah, right, but it was like clearly a hallucination. Kind of like
still
of,
scary.
Yeah, but it played like the first time you see it, you're sort of like, what's going on here? But and it was pretty harsh for a Spielberg-y sort of thing.
That was still pre PG-13, right? When that one hit.
That Poltergeist is what kind of made Poltergeist is the movie people point to, that and a few others that kind of invented PG-13, because there had to be something harder than PG, but Poltergeist is certainly not R.
Mostly Steven Spielberg. I think it was Steven Spielberg's divorce that basically spurned PG-13.
You're in a dark place, you're gonna make darker stuff, you know.
Well, he made Temple of Doom, and then he was producing Gremlins, and you know,
and again, there's people out there that don't like Temple of Doom, and I have to say, fuck you.
Okay,
but so Siskel and Ebert were clucking their tongues over Temple of Doom being, you know, getting all violent, especially Siskel got all like,
he was a wiener.
They both were wieners. They were from Chicago.
They're gonna cream their pants over whatever you know. If it's a movie that's gonna win awards, it can be as violent as you want. But if it's a popcorn movie for the masses, we're concerned about the level of violence. It's like, kiss my ass, dude. Okay, guess what? If you're making movies to win awards, you're appealing to a different audience. If you're making movies that are popcorn movies that are being released to make money, if the market will bear it, then the market will bear it. If there's no market for it, they're not going to make any money. They're going to stop making them. That drives me nuts. It's like, how can we have more of these? Because they keep making money.
Because people enjoy them.
Maybe if they didn't make money, they'd stop making them. And and then if they stop making money, they stop making them. They would stop subsidizing the low interest, low return on investment award movies that you guys love so damn much.
Maybe they thought their opinion was so important that if they drubbed the movies that people, they could shame people from going to see the movies. But
you can't shame people into not liking what they like.
That they're nobody. I remember the Friday the 13th movies, they were and the Freddy movies were a communal experience for high school kids. Everybody, like, everybody wanted to go to with their girlfriends and, you know, with all their friends, and they wanted it to be stupid. They if it got stupider, they were fine. They'd be in they're getting drunk in the parking lot and, you know, yelling during the movie and stuff. And so it was a thing to do, you know. The thing about it is, Gene Siskel is always just a turd, and I always liked Roger Ebert, but as I look back on it, it's like, at least Gene Siskel was consistent in what he would cluck his, Roger Ebert was doing, you know, nudie movies with Russ Meyer, and hanging out with him so he could be around big booby girls. And then he would come out and this is one of the reasons that I liked him when I was a kid. He would come out and be like, Dawn of the Dead, this movie is great, you know. Now, warning, it's very violent, so know when you go and don't take your kids to it, and know when you go in there, this is
going
to be
something. That's
it,
I'm fucking going.
Violent you've ever seen. But he's like, this is a very good movie and blah, blah, blah. And Gene Siskel would, at best, sort of, you know, sometimes just go, well, I agree there's some parts of this that are well written, but brr, 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 brr. But then there would be other times where Ebert would get just as self-righteous about something that he should have been. Like, it's like, oh, you like Dawn of the Dead, but you don't like this? What's I mean?
Well, it comes down to that with, like, any fucking odd. It's like, look, yeah, Steel Magnolias and Fried Green Tomatoes, are they my cup of tea? No. Are they well-written, well-directed movies? Yeah, and I'm not going to slag on somebody of, like, if that's one of your favorite flicks, fucking knock yourself out. It's not going to be my choice on a Saturday night to watch.
Yeah,
but
I wouldn't choose Steel Magnolias, and I've never seen Steel Magnolias. Fried Green Tomatoes is an example, you know? Like, before the internet, when you could totally choose whatever you wanted to watch, whenever you wanted to watch, you know, I would, you know, the TV would have somebody else in the house would have rented, you know, one of the girls in the house would have rented Fried Green Tomatoes. And, well, the movie was playing, so I'll sit down and watch it. And I would get sucked into it. You know, I wouldn't be like, I love that movie. But I would, you know, remember going, I had a solid script. It, you know, the acting was good. And I'm a sucker for movies. I like to get into something that I'm watching.
Yeah.
And
so what
you're saying is you're comparing yourself to John Travolta from Be Cool, basically.
Sure. I don't think I've ever seen
that. I have no idea what that movie
is. Wait, you've never seen Be Cool?
You've never seen Get Shorty and Be Cool?
Nope.
No.
Hold up. Okay, hold up. I'll give you the elevator pitch, okay? John Travolta plays a leg breaker for the mafia, right, who gets sent out to Hollywood, right? But he also has a screenplay, and he's like a big movie guy. He loves the movies. So it's him doing his job as a leg breaker, but also, hey, he's got this screenplay. Have you heard about this screenplay that he's pushing?
Okay.
Wait. Get Shorty is very funny. But you got to see Get Shorty, because then you have to see Be Cool. Be Cool, besides having our cousin in it, who is he literally plays the exact same role he played on The Sopranos. But, like, The Rock plays a homosexual, and what's his face? Vince Vaughn, Twinkle Twinkle, baby, Twinkle Twinkle. I kind of think, like, that movie is so – Haley has never seen Get Shorty, but she's seen the parts with Anthony in it in Be Cool, and then she saw The Rock. She goes, why is The Rock dressed like – Oh, I kind of think, because she's seen Birdcage, right?
Yeah.
And then Vince Vaughn, Twinkle Twinkle, baby, Twinkle Twinkle. She goes, what's wrong with that man? And I was like, that's Vince Vaughn. She goes, holy shit. I kind of think, but yeah, no, those are great. Anyway, okay. I just want to throw this out there. Steel Magnolias, one of the most depressing fucking movies ever, right? But it has some great lines in it, which are the only redeeming values for me watching it, because the movie literally rips your fucking heart out and kicks you in the nuts the whole time. Because, hey, why not? What I wanted to say was, 1985, this is the other movies that came out in 85 that might be of interest, right? Day of the Dead, Demons, the original, the first one, Return of the Living Dead, Reanimator, Fright Night, Phenomenon, a.k.a. Creepers. Your Friday the 13th that year was New Beginning, so but wait, your Nightmare on Elm Street that year was Freddy's Revenge, so the gayest horror movie ever made, right? So House, you know, and again, Cat's Eye came out that year, Life Force, The Stuff, which is a classic.
Never enough of The Stuff.
Yeah,
now, and Ghoulies. Wonderful stuff.
Right, kind of thing, and Ghoulies.
As covered on this very
Ghoulies.
Now, wait a minute. Hold up a sec. Ghoulies and House, I was thinking about this earlier, actually have a lot of things in common. Okay?
Yes, they do. Yes, right, they
so
do.
So Ghoulies was Empire Pictures. This was New World. The mark of quality, New World Pictures, right? Both of them are horror comedies, right? Both have VHS horror rack hangers on. Both have extremely memorable VHS cover boxes. Okay, both spawned a series of sequels of varying quality that had very little to tie them back to the original other than the main premise.
Yeah. Right?
They're essentially both, the same thing.
Both except have a prominent toilet scene.
Yes. I was going to say, both of them involve the toilet. Now, I will say this. There is no way in hell that hand is going down that toilet.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. You're
flushing that hand now. You are going to be sneaking the shit out of that commode in about a week. The electric snake man's going to make his money that day. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
But that's a movie trope. I was gonna chop that up to the 80s, but then I was thinking about it, and it runs right up to modern times, where in movies they just go, whatever you throw in the toilet, whether it be a head, a hand, you know, 400 pool balls or whatever, if it goes in the toilet and you put the lid down and you hit flush, it's going down, you know. And that's one of the biggest lies that the movies have told us. Right. When you just think there's nothing my ass could make that would ever stuff up a toilet. I saw House, and then you end up with your whole bathroom flooded, and it's bullshit.
So real quick, 1986. So this is the other end of this, because you know House is the 85-86 thing. 86, The Fly, The Hitcher, Manhunter. These are all a little different level horror.
Yeah, a little different,
right? From Beyond, which is a great one. Okay, so you had Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. But that year you also got Poltergeist 2. You got Chopping Mall. You got Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Night of the Creeps, Neon Maniacs, which I don't know if you guys have ever seen, but if you haven't, John LeMay? No, who did it with me? It wasn't John LeMay. It was, I'm totally blanking who did it with me. Jonathan Nimbody, and I covered that on Boss Bugs and Babes. The movie's insane. But there's also a little movie called Aliens came out that same year. So I'm just saying there was kind of like, you kind of House kind of fell perfectly. 85 is it's. I mean, those movies, the 85 movies are good movies, but we're not talking Aliens. We're not talking like some of the biggest heavy hitters. Like, by the way, again, whether people liked Manhunter when it came out or not, Manhunter was. I mean, that's Silence of the Lambs, for fuck's sake, kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? That's what that led to those things, because it's the same. It's Red Dragon.
Well, it's Red Dragon. Yes.
There are some heavy hitters that year. I mean, there's some shit. There's April Fool's Day and The Wrath and Psycho 2. But, like, I'm just saying, and, like, Deadly
Friend.
But I'm saying, but Psycho 2 was not Psycho. And it was also, like, 25 years later. So you're like, this again? You know, kind of thing.
Well, you know what's funny is, like, now that's commonplace, right?
Yeah.
Now it's like, oh, we're making a sequel to this movie from two and a half decades ago. People are like, fuck yeah, man. We're getting Gladiator 2 for crying out loud.
I know.
Like, for reals, right? This is the really real world right now, okay? Because Ridley Scott's like, what are you going to do about it? Nothing, that's what, you know? That
also, real quick, just want to throw one more movie 95. That might be a little different. Henry Portrait Serial Killer also came out that year. Just saying, could you be more different than House than Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer? Let's just say.
Well, they both take place in houses.
Everyone thought Michael Rooker was, in all fairness, anyone who saw Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer really believed that Michael Rooker really was a serial killer. People to this day still have a hard time believing that he's fucking Mary Poppins. I'm just saying, people have a hard time believing that.
Well, you know what, though? It made his role as Rowdy Burns in Days of Thunder that much believable because he knew he was fucking with Cole Tripper because look at him. He's got dead eyes, man.
Yeah. I'm just saying. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is one of those things that I think I've only ever seen it once.
It's one of those ones.
It's one of those movies you watch once. Yeah.
I've seen it. I know I've watched it all the way through once. I don't know if I ever watched any part of it again. I mean, I've seen clips of it, or whatever. But it's one of those movies that you just watch once, and you don't have to watch it again I've seen it. Right? It's so funny because people say the same thing about Maniac. I know we're getting off topic here, but like how Maniac scarred them. I've seen Maniac like probably a dozen times. Right? It's not a fun movie. I'm not describing anything fun here, but like those movies kind of really stay with you. Think about this for a second. We're talking about House here. There's parts of this movie that we kind of like ripped on, whatever. But the poster for House is more iconic than pretty much. I mean, it's one of the most iconic posters of the 80s just because it was on shelves all the time, right?
Yeah.
There's things in this movie that stick with you, even if you haven't seen this, like Luke said, in 3 decades.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's so funny that like how different a movie are we talking? We're talking about literally you go from the most realist, real, disgusting, visceral thing, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, those kind of things, like, how real can you get with that? To, like, this movie's zany at times.
Oh, it's zany.
Then the next scene, you're like, the guy, how's this guy not eating a shotgun? Like, how is he not killing himself if he's so depressed?
You're like at that point in time where the 80s and the 90s are starting to mix together. And, you know, the stuff in the 80s, you know, House is more 80s than it is 90s. Yep. But then you move over to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and that's definitely going in the, gritty realism and, you know, edginess and stuff like that. And that was more of the, and, you know, and I think the, I think, literally, like, the evil, like, I think, Evil Dead 2 was another one that sort of was pushing towards the 90s, you know, in the 80s, and Return of the Living Dead, you know, like the going over the top with horror and stuff like that. And so it was like really like, I mean, and there were, you know, and there were the dying embers of the 80s, and then there was the stuff that was still working like House, you know. But it was also just sort of like one of the last of its kind, you know, of that sort of thing.
Well, the one thing I can definitely say is you didn't get a lot. I mean, things were at least trying to be different, too. You know, you kind of think because you had so many cookie cutter things coming out of there. Uh-huh. Once they figured out the formula for slasher movies, once they took the stopwatch to it and counted out, like you just knew what had to be there. You had sometimes, because again, you could make those same cookie-cutter movies, and the law and diminishing returns eventually said you're not going to make as much on every one of them as you were. But, like, sometimes you had something weird, so had something different, had something out there. I mean, Night of the Creeps, exact same time, 86, right? Night of the Creeps, it, like, is such a weird kind of movie in what you're getting. You're like, I mean, it's an alien invasion movie, but it's also a straight-up zombie movie at times. But it has some of the best fucking one-liners of the entire 80s in it, you know, kind of thing. And like, but how is that? Because this movie starts off in the 50s. Like, you know, it's just you started getting some of those things that were different. And those are the ones that stand out, I think, and when we're remembering things, because they stand out as not being the exact same thing over and over and over again. You know, even if you love slasher movies, I love slasher movies, but like, even if you love all your slasher movies, at some point, Slaughter High and what's the other one? Is it Fatal? What's the one? Fatal Instinct. What's it called? Killer Party. And well, like,
Killer Party's a comedy though. What?
No. What I'm saying is, but like those movies that they kind of were making. They kind of were like the high school kind of thing, whatever. And then the whatever, like kind of thing. They tried to, this is the one that's aping off of Prom Night. And this is the one that's aping off of this and whatever kind of thing. Even if it was straight or comedy. What's the other one besides Slaughter High? What's the other one that's just like Slaughter High?
Return to Horror High with the film crew?
No, is Slaughter High the one where he gets burned with the acid in the lab?
Yeah, Slaughter High is the one with Carolyn Monroe. We watched it on this.
Yeah, yep. Isn't there another one where they go back to the school and it's a separate one? Different. I don't. Maybe I'm misremembering something together with it. But yeah. I'm saying, I thought there was another territory. One. I thought there was another one. They went back to the school again, but it wasn't. Maybe it is Slaughter High I'm thinking of. But I think there's another one that's not Slaughter High. It's this. I had a shirt. Mausoleum.
Mausoleum. What's that? Yes.
That has another name too. But it's the same similar idea. They're very similar ideas in these movies. So when you have something like again House that stands out as being different, you remember it. So, but yeah, I think it also speaks volumes to the fact that I think we've all seen so many movies that just you know.
It's all just a jumble now.
Especially when you're watching genre stuff that just has, you know, like so many. I mean, so many slasher movies and horror movies of that time period were just, you know, they got enough money together to make the movie, and then it just becomes like, you're just dragged through the, you know, the tropes as they go along, you know. Yeah. Hoping that there'll be some good blood that the special effects crew were good on this one or something like that. But usually, like a lot of times, it's a joyless slog through them, you know. And yeah. A lot of those movies, I think, just, you know, have sort of fallen by the wayside. So it doesn't seem like there was so many of them nowadays because the better stuff has just sort of risen to the top. And there's still a ton of that, too, you know. Or the better to, like, mediocre good stuff, you know, there's enough of those to watch on YouTube forever, and you know, the really bad ones that you would catch on like Cinemax every once in a while just have sort of disappeared from people's minds, thank God.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is that a lot of these movies, there was so many of them, right? We talk about some of these movies kind of in passing, you know, is that a lot of them now, they only exist as either an outfit like, I just threw this into the chat, like an outfit like Lunch Meat will do a VHS special edition, or they get picked up by Vinegar Syndrome or something like that, you know, yeah. But that's for those little movies. But a film like Howl's, like I said, it was popular enough. It's won enough sequels. It's memorable enough. It's everywhere. You can watch it on Prime Video. You can watch it on Tubi, on Pluto. Yeah. It's all over the place.
It's on YouTube, in 4K. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not, like I said, it's not the best movie. But it's certainly better than a lot of the schlock that came out around it. And it's still memorable for what it does well. It's memorable. Like I said, I think later ones would get the balance of the comedy and horror a bit better and be more entertaining. But as a VHS movie, the era is a reason why it stood out. And I thought I really had a hard time with it today. But even talking about it, it's like, yeah, I can see some of that stuff, you know. So it has its merits.
Yeah, if you've never seen it and you get 90 minutes, throw it on. This is another one, 6-pack and a pizza. The atmosphere is pretty good. It's a little goony at times, but there's definitely some stuff in it that at the end of it, you're gonna go, oh shit, that was pretty cool.
Well, the warts and inconsistencies in it are still kind of interesting. You know, they're not like, they don't ruin the movie for you. It's just like, oh, that was an interesting choice or something like that. But at the same time, it makes it less predictable and, frankly, more interesting to watch, you know. So, yeah. It's one of those strange things where I went, I saw it in the movie theater. I haven't seen it since. And I had pretty much the same reaction to it both times, which I guess that's a pretty good sign.
Yeah.
As if they were positive reactions, which they were.
Like I said, I'm curious, yeah. And I'll throw it out to the listeners. What, again, House is everywhere. Watch it and email us, freakvault@gmail.com. Yeah. Because, like I said, yeah. I didn't care for it, but the other guys seem to care for it more. I'm curious what the listeners think. So freakvault@gmail.com. I'll even write it down. I'll make sure to check the damn email this time. And
yeah, well, I wonder.
Well, I'm really curious what the listeners think about this one.
Yes,
I'd like
please.
To find somebody I'm sure there's House haters out there, but I'm really more curious to what the serious hardcore House head is like. House head.
Impromptu double feature. Watch this and then watch In the Mouth of Madness.
Oh, that's covered a million zillion years ago on this podcast.
Yeah, well, they're both about tormented writers.
Tortured writers. That's right.
Strings of shows, yeah.
And that way you don't have to watch The Dark Half or any other Stephen King adaptation about a tortured writer. There you go.
See, I haven't
the main
watched
difference that. The main difference between this and a Stephen King adaptation, at no point does somebody say that the air smelled vaguely of burning rubber.
And there's no greasers in this that you have to watch out for. So, you know, there you go.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Oh, please. He'll never learn to speak in this environment.
Afternoon, everybody.